Hello, and welcome to a special summer edition of the Cambridge American History Seminar podcast. Professor Nick Guyot, Fellow of Jesus College, Cambridge, and historian of colonial America, joins us to discuss his role as editor of the upcoming Oxford Illustrated History of the United States and a conference recently held at Cambridge organized around its publication. Professor Guyot has most recently authored The Hated Cage, An American Tragedy in Britain's Most Terrifying Prison, and Bind Us Apart, How Enlightened Americans Invented Racial Segregation. We're joined as well by Caleb Woodall, a PhD candidate at Cambridge who studies gender, World War II, and conscientious objectors. Our thanks to Nick and Caleb for taking the time to have this conversation. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy. So hello and welcome back to the Cambridge American History Seminar podcast. We've got a special episode this week with Nick Guyot. What we want to do is give people a taster of a conference that was recently conducted here at Cambridge. So, Nick, can you tell us about the conference, and you can tell us about the book that the conference was related to?
Yeah, sure. Thanks very much, Hugh. So we had, back in June, a conference here which we've been planning for, was it 3 years? I think we've probably been planning it for more like 4 years, because it was supposed to happen in June of 2020. And the plan originally was to gather together 15 or 16 scholars, mostly from the US, who are working on chapters for the new Oxford Illustrated History of the United States. And the reason that we were going to have them here is because I'm editing that volume, and I agreed, I think, to take it on back in 2017. So the plan was, bring all of these guys that I've asked to write chapters of this book to Cambridge. We'll do like a workshop. We will have something kind of private where we can talk about whether the chapters really are working or not. And then we'll have like one public event. And a public event will be pretty sure, and maybe it will be about history wars, or maybe it will be about something. But the plan was to do most of the stuff behind closed doors. But then everything was set up for June of 2020. And obviously, it was not a great time to be organizing a conference. But as it turned out, neither was June of 2021. And in fact, several Junes afterwards were not great. So while we were postponing and postponing and postponing, we basically had work on the volume carrying on. And all of these folks I was working with were completing their chapters. So we got to the point where, towards the end of last year, all 15 of the authors, 16 if you count me, you probably should because I am in the book, so 16 of the authors, we basically all kind of finished our chapters. So the rationale for having people come to Cambridge had completely gone. But we still thought it would be fun to have them here because these guys have been writing the first kind of collaborative single volume history of the United States in ages. And for reasons we could get into, this is a really interesting time to be writing a kind of one volume history of the US. And I think in the process of putting together the volume, we've made some quite interesting and controversial choices about kind of how we would structure this book, the kinds of things we focus on. So the plan then changed. And instead of having like a workshop, we decided to have like a full kind of day and a half conference, which we called Writing American History in Uncertain Times. And that Uncertain Times bit we stole from the Organization of American Historians, who just had a conference out in LA, which had that subtitle about uncertain times. And we invited as many of the folks that could get here, which in the end was 11 of us rather than the full 16. And we had a number of different panels that were kind of focused on different aspects of what the book is trying to do. So one of those panels, just very briefly to give you a sense of the arc of it, was sort of focused on geography. So kind of where is the United States? When we're doing the history of the US, how does that connect to histories of the wider world? We had another one that was about chronology, about periodization, about the kind of standard stories we use to try and narrate the American past, and whether some of those need to be given a bit of a kicking, rearranged, reimagined. And we had a panel that was more focused on, well, to put it in crude terms, how hard it is to write American history, knowing that the moment that what you've written gets into the public, it's super politicized. So for example, it doesn't just have to be someone writing about the last 20 years, although that obviously is a big challenge. If you're writing about slavery now, or if you're writing about indigenous people, or if you're writing about, say, the revolutionary era and justice and, you know, judges and the legal system, you know that when you publish whatever you've written, when it hits the public, potentially people are going to have a kind of feeding frenzy about it. So we had a panel on that too. And then we had one final big event about history wars and about some of the stuff going on in the US right now in places like Florida and Texas, and sort of how hard it is to write and to teach and to kind of be active as an American historian in that kind of climate. So it's a lot of fun. Had a lot of people there. Great to see you guys and a bunch of other people. And I think it was good because we don't, as a profession, get the chance very often to pull back out and think about US history as kind of like an entire thing. And we were able to do that over the course of the 2 days. So.
Yeah, thank you. So, Caleb, you just want to jump in there?
Yeah, so we'll definitely speak more specifically about the panel structure you spoke about, and especially about politicisation. But jumping on what you said about pulling out and looking at history as a general thing, what's different about this book compared to the rest of, say, general histories on offer of the US? How is this not just US history as one thing after the other?
Yeah. Well, are you suggesting one thing after another is bad, Caleb? Or is there a little bit of prejudice in
I'm just reading the questions. Yeah, we'll get into that.
I'm reading what I've been given. I don't know. Do you guys have a favourite one volume history of the US? Do you even have one?
I don't think I do, actually. I can't see one on the shelf, which means I don't think so.
I mean, the most famous recent one is Joe Lepore's book, These Truths. Yeah. But have you guys actually read it?
No.
God, I really put you on the spot now.
Yeah.
We're turning this interview around. So I only mention that because, like, what is a one-volume history of the US for? So if you think a little bit about in history, I guess, or like just in terms of what they've done, the kind of work they've done, say in the last 100 years, most one-volume or two-volume histories of the US are textbooks, right? Mm-hmm. Like, not many people are picking them up actually to understand the United States. Most people are picking it up, or one volume history, because they've been assigned a particular book to take them across a whole American history course. So again, I'm not quite sure about what the sales breakdown might look like, but my guess is the vast majority of these books are going into education rather than to kind of the general reader. Well, the series that we're in, so this Oxford Illustrated History series, is a bit of a break with that. So the plan is that rather than writing them as textbooks, and rather than having a single author or a couple of authors, or with a lot of the big American history textbooks in the US, they've got like four or five authors. But basically, the four or five authors, you don't know who's written what. So all of them are kind of subsumed within a single authoritative voice, right? This particular series from Oxford is really cool because they get between 10 and 15, 16 authors. Each one of them does a chapter. And in effect, what you get is a commitment, I guess, to a common approach or a set of common approaches. But you get a lot of singularity and distinctiveness in what people want to write about. So as the editor, I wasn't in a place where I said to people, I need you to write it this way. Or here is a bunch of stuff that I need you to cover in this chapter. Instead, I could kind of just let people do what they want. So just to give you an example, Joyce Chaplin, we managed to persuade her to do the first chapter of the whole book. And so that chapter is called Before the United States. In a lot of single volume histories of the US, that chapter would either be quite short, or if it were longer even, it would be super colonial. So it would basically be the colonial story. Mm-hmm. Joyce, because she's Joyce, decides to start with like the meteor, you know, the asteroid hitting the Gulf of Mexico, or creating the Gulf of Mexico 65 million years ago. And that was awesome. And fully the first third to a half of the chapter is thinking about the consequences, not just of the kind of impact of the meteor, but also the kinds of human societies that grew up before the arrival of Euro-American societies in the 16th century. And it's a really fascinating perspective because one of the really sly things that she does is gets you to think about the way in which, in a sense, many of the possibilities for life, for industry, for society in North America are like natural and geographical. The way we usually tell American history is to think about a lot of those possibilities being created by Europeans, being created by, you know, all of this technology, all of this knowledge that's coming from Europe. And she takes us back and is like, well, actually, no, the natural, the geographical, the serendipity of all of that kind of natural history is much more important for understanding how societies took hold. And the cool part is then to say, we're now in the 21st century at a place where we can see we have changed nature, but we're also reminded of the fact that those changes have made nature a really vivid actor in American history again. In terms of climate change. So that's just a kind of example of the way in which having her do that, like if she'd done the whole book, like let's say she wrote a one volume, I'm sure it'd be a brilliant one volume history, but you might actually find that either a bit gimmicky or a bit samey across like 800 pages. Here it's like 30, 35 pages, first chapter, bang. And then if you love that, awesome. If you didn't, that didn't land for you completely, well look, the next chapter's by Honor Sachs and she's a completely different kind of historian. So the hope is that you get across the book a sense that you have a really cool and interesting gang of people that can kind of lead you along. They're telling you something that they know, but they're also giving you a sense of their particular kind of predilections, their particular kind of taste for doing particular kinds of American history, and the insights that have been important to them in shaping their careers and their work. So I think as a format, it doesn't really look like a textbook, but I still think it gives you a lot of the basic stuff that you need if you were, you know, landing from Mars to understand US history. If you had just this book, you would still be able to get a lot of the basics that all of you guys would have gotten from, you know, lectures or from textbooks or whatever else. So I think the format's really cool. I would say that Oxford haven't necessarily always use the format for countries in a really, really exciting way. So the other titles in the series, there's one on the First World War, there's one on the Renaissance, there's a really famous one on Britain, but that one was published in 1984, all of the authors are male, and it's very, very traditional. It's also sold a million copies. So you're like, have we made a mistake in making this format kind of more interesting? But I do think, I should have mentioned the pictures. There are pictures, did they mention that?
It's illustrated.
Yeah, so it's illustrated. Although this is the funny part of this, I hope I don't get in trouble by telling you their secret here, but the way Oxford does this is that they say you need to pick like 12 or 14 pictures for each one of the chapters, and then obviously figure out how to get all the permissions. So, I mean, anyone listening, you'll know that if you've like been involved in a book, getting the permissions actually to reproduce the images is a much bigger nightmare than you'd ever imagine. But there's a bit of a budget for that, blah, blah, blah. So what they told us is we let it sit on the shelves for like 3 years. It's not that expensive, so probably when it comes out, it'll be about 25 quid, which is pricey, but for a ton of illustrations and whatever else, that's actually not that pricey. You know, big sort of 500, 600 page book. Mm-hmm. But then they said, after 3 years, we just tear out all the pictures. And then we call it the Oxford History of the United States. So this is important, because what this means is you have to tell the contributors that none of their images that they've picked can be like mission critical. So let's say you wanted in your chapter to spend like 5 minutes talking about a particular image or an object that you want to depict in the illustrated version, can't do that. Because when they tear out the images, you'll be like, I know. So it's also quite interesting to think about how you have all these cool ideas for how you can subvert the format, but the format also has a way, you know, a bit like nature, of kind of coming back and smashing you. So
yeah, well, amazing. Thanks for the inside track there. But so we wanted to get into the panels that you mentioned.
Sure.
And the first one was dealing with narratives. Mm-hmm. We've talked, and the conference talks a lot about the falling apart of familiar narratives about the American past. Yep. So what are these familiar narratives? How are they unraveling? And how does the historian navigate this landscape and kind of contribute to that unraveling?
Well, I think there were a bunch that we talked about on the day. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that conversation about narratives wasn't really completely contained within that panel, because it came back at other moments. So I can tell you a bit about the guidance that I circulated to everyone when we got started with the project back in 2017, 2018. One of the narratives that we were going to try and challenge, or at least, is critique the right word? Maybe we should say stress test, because perhaps some of these narratives deserve like a bit of respect from us because they've been as durable as they have been. But one of them is that the United States is still on a kind of upward curve of its development, both in terms of its kind of prosperity, but perhaps its relative power. So if you think for the period that all of us have worked on, in for the most part, the United States, certainly through the second half of the 19th century, maybe even earlier, has been on this kind of trajectory where you could imagine that its relative influence in terms of other societies is getting ever greater. And then the question that I asked people to think about in the book is whether we did actually sometime in the past few decades reach the zenith of that. And actually, whether you want to talk about China or other countries, maybe a kind of conglomerate of other countries like the BRICS or whatever else, have we got to a point where those countries now are actually more powerful or becoming more powerful in comparison to the United States? And the reason I say this is about narrative is because, I mean, we all know, right, that a lot of the basic stories that Americans told themselves about their nation were rooted in ideas of exceptionalism, which had both a kind of moral component, but also a geographical one. So in other words, the United States was going to be the most liberal, the most kind of freedom-loving space, but also it was going to be a space that had a kind of commitment to transmit, to kind of transplant those ideas and ideals around the world. And you see that all the way from the French Revolution. You maybe even see it in Tom Paine before the French Revolution, in Common Sense. But you certainly see it running throughout the 19th and 20th century. And it's not an unbroken thread, but it's a really, really important one. So one of the narratives that we kind of challenged or at least kind of interrogated, was whether actually now, from our position within the 21st century, we as historians have a different relationship to the operation of that narrative about American power than perhaps you might have done if we were writing this book in, say, even the 1990s, where the US still seemed pretty darned powerful, the kind of, you know, lonely superpower, global hegemon, unipolar world moment. So that's one. There was, to give you a completely different example, the narrative about the Black freedom struggle. So something, I guess, that is happened before all of the emphasis on this that came from the 1619 project of the New York Times back in 2019. But in a sense, the challenge of figuring out whether struggles for equality, for rights, for recognition, for citizenship on the part of peoples of color, but particularly peoples of African descent, whether those struggles are best sublimated into a kind of single freedom struggle, or whether it makes more sense for us to try and think about distinct periods, distinct kind of phases, which might be subsets of that bigger struggle, or might actually be better thought of as their own discrete things. So the difference between thinking about, say, the civil rights struggle as having its own kind of integrity, as opposed to seeing it as merely part of this much broader Black freedom struggle. So that's a story that Will Jones in Minnesota, who's writing our chapter on civil rights, talked about. And actually, he said he's really keen to try and keep that focus on civil rights. Like, he doesn't think that the idea of an unbroken and unending Black freedom struggle is analytically all that useful. Just one last one, just to give you a sense of where these narratives might come from or go. I think that we probably, as American historians, and particularly folks who've worked within the United States, have tended to assume that the United States government is either, if not perfect, it's perfectible. So in other words, whether we're thinking about originalism or thinking about the kind of place of late 18th century constitutions in the kind of later centuries and in the kind of modern political imagination, it's been a tendency to assume that, although there are bumps along the road, civil war is a fairly big one, that actually the basic machinery of American government has a kind of genius to it, right?
Yeah.
And again, we can talk about this empirically. There are plenty of ways in which one can be very impressed, despite all of the things that one wouldn't be impressed by in American history, at some of its constitutional kind of innovations and stabilities. But you begin to wonder, I think, for example, when you take into account the persistence and a kind of grinding longevity of exclusion, particularly of Black people, but also of other peoples of color or indigenous people from the American political experiment, or other kinds of problems or issues like, say, what's going on with the judiciary in the last 10 or 15 years, or the way in which the federal system grants so much power to smaller states as opposed to larger states, where it actually begins to seem as if that machinery hasn't just been kind of like corrupted, or it hasn't just found itself contaminated by partisanship or whatever in the present, but actually there might be some major problems with the machinery itself. And that's sort of a bit heretical. I mean, when we talk about this now, right, we can't talk about it really just as historians, because we're also like crazily living it in the moment. And that was another thing the conference, I guess, got into, that it's really difficult for us as historians to find a way to talk about the past with fresher narratives that doesn't feel itself like some kind of commentary on the politics of the present. But I think all three of those narratives are ones that, during the conference, we were really keen to try to tackle. And I think in the book too, you'll see those kinds of narratives, I would say tested, that's the word I would use. Not all of them thrown out, but tested for sure.
Yeah, thank you. So I think Caleb's going to ask a bit now about national history.
Yeah, so the second panel of the day dealt with the limits of national history. National history's sort of been challenged by a turn towards transnational, global histories. How do we write a national history of the US which accounts for its transition from a regional to a global power?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? So here in Cambridge, and in the UK more generally, we have quite an interesting relationship to US history. So anyone that might be listening to this podcast from the US, every nation has its own kind of premium in terms of its own history. So I sometimes refer to this as being like a multiplier. Like, essentially, if you're trying to teach history in the United States, the US is going to have like a big multiplier, right? Because you're in the US. So there's an assumption that everyone needs American history as a kind of civics thing. The UK is weird because American history, US history, was really created here in the UK, principally in the 1940s, as one of the very first national histories beyond British history that we all dealt with as national history. So I'm not saying we didn't do French or German or whatever else history, but we tend to think about, like, even now in Cambridge, about European history. So there'll be all these like subnational things within it. But actually, we think about American history as US history. So there's this fascinating way in which we here in the UK, principally because of the Cold War, kind of signed up to this project of trying to teach our school kids and then our university kids as well about the idea that the US deserved a kind of national multiplier in the same way Britain did, which is weird. I mean, or at least it's historically specific and contingent. So one of the questions, I guess, both from a kind of teaching point of view and a research point of view, and maybe also a kind of like thinking about America from outside the United States point of view, should we still carry on doing that? So actually, is it helpful for us to keep alive this idea of the US as a separate national history? Or would it make more sense for us to think about it in regional context? So that your initial question is more about, you know, the volume and about the conference itself, but I wanted to kind of throw that in there because I think there are lots of interesting questions about why US history, in a way, I understand why it's been quite parochial sometimes in the US, quite inwardly focused. But I almost feel like when we've done it over here, we've also ended up incubating a kind of inward focus to it, right, as British people who are interested in American history. The panel, though, was principally talking about how you reconcile, well, a couple of things. One of them, the idea that when we think about US history, we very often think about it in continental dimensions. So Corinne Walter of Georgetown Cutter, who is writing our chapter on the 19th century and US foreign relations, did a fantastic job of talking about how different US history looks, the kind of domestic narrative of US history, when you incorporate indigenous people and you say effectively indigenous nations are foreign nations. And that's not Corinne's revelation, like lots of other people have talked about in the last 10 years, but I think she's done a fantastic job of structuring a whole kind of chapter around that. And even placing things like the Mexican War or the Spanish-American War, Filipino War at the end of the 19th century in that context. So that was kind of one instance from the inside out where this is a challenge. Another one, Eric Rauchway of University of California, Davis talked about, which is how you write a US history of the New Deal and of the kind of Great Depression New Deal moment when so many of the things that you're kind of relying on are international. So many of the kind of dimensions, so many of the geopolitical and kind of economic considerations that in a way shape that era go beyond the United States. So what we tried to do in the volume, and I think the panel reflected this too, is we actually do have two historians who are out there doing dedicated chapters. So there's Corinne Walter and there's Penny Von Eschen of the University of Virginia, who are writing a kind of pre-1900 and post-1900 US and the world chapter. So they each have their own chapter. But I think the spirit has been to try and imagine in every chapter that the United States is not a kind of discrete space where, in effect, geography has given it this incredible privilege of being able to develop without worrying about the rest of the world. I mean, I think that's absolute bullshit. Are we allowed to say bullshit? I think that's completely bullshit. Yeah. Vision of the world, but it's one that was for the longest time ingrained in certain ways of thinking about the United States. So I think every chapter tries to pick up on that interplay between the national, the regional, the international, and the global, obviously starting with Joyce Chaplin at the beginning, but then going all the way through to Nathan Connolly's chapter at the end. So I guess one wouldn't want in a national history of the United States not to foreground all the dynamics which are regional, international, and global. Throughout American history, there's never been a moment where those things don't actually condition really basic facts about the development of the nation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right.
That's a good answer. Got more? So we'll deal with the final panel now. We've got a few questions here because okay. I think this is kind of the most contentious one. Well, not necessarily, but anyway. So it was history, teleology, and the problems of now. It's about writing history now in uncertain times, as with the name of the conference. Mm-hmm. So I'll start quite broadly. Why should historians bother with the present?
Do you mean why should they write the history of the present or worry about the present?
Why should we worry
history?
About it at all?
I don't know. I mean, I mean, it's difficult, right? Because in some ways, like in my own life or in my own career, that's not a question I really think about that often, simply because it seems to me that you can't not worry about. I mean, it feels like getting out of the present at any moment is impossible.
Yeah.
So the mission or the kind of responsibility would be to be as honest as you can be about the distinction between you trying to think about the past on its own terms and you acknowledging that you write, you teach, you research for the present, and I don't mean that in a kind of Whiggish way, I just mean like that's the space in which all of this stuff actually takes place, right? So I think for all of us as American historians, we probably all felt kind of quickening maybe of the pace back in 2015, 2016. Well, okay, let me back up. One of the reasons that, so without wishing to get completely into sort of questions of race and positionality, for a white scholar, the moment in 2015, 2016, where you sort of get this sudden movement to Trump, that's a moment where it begins to seem as if the pace is quickening. If you're a scholar of color, especially an African-American scholar, there's probably never been a moment where American history didn't have much more urgent and basic questions. It's just that, like, you know, as a white scholar, you get to go home for the weekend and not worry about those in quite the same way as if you're a scholar of color. I was thinking you probably would have named 2013 or 2012 as a moment where if you were focused more on the histories of race, then a Black Lives Matter moment would have kind of crashed in. But the point I'm trying to make about the quickening, you know, of your kind of historical sensibility is just the sense that there is some really urgent stuff happening right now, which appears to make you as a historian seem particularly relevent. And you guys know that, do you remember that the video of Tom Cruise? Do you remember that Tom Cruise video, the secret Scientology one? I'm not a Cruise hater, can I just say that right away? I'm not saying Scientology is good, but you know there's that video where he was getting an award from Scientology, do you remember this?
That's a long time ago, I think.
I thought about this when I won a teaching award, so I couldn't go to the dinner because I worried I might do the Tom Cruise thing. So he recorded this special video, and Cruise in the video is like, you know, I saw this car crash by the side of the freeway, and I turned off my car, I turned it away from the road, and I stopped because I knew I was the only one that could help. So it seems to me that, I mean, the guy's not like a paramedic, right? So it seems to me that that mentality that we as historians can like help with things is not necessarily a good one for us to like incubate or cultivate. But at the same time, when you see, for example, in my field of like 18th, 19th century history, someone like Andrew Jackson suddenly screech back into the popular consciousness under Trump, you know, with Trump kind of comparing himself to Jackson or whatever else, you just think, okay, well, this is a moment where it feels that as historians, in the wider culture, we sort of stop being a nice to have at this moment and we've become something a bit more essential. Mm-hmm. Now, I guess there's a way of thinking about history that says that recognizing that or having that insight will undoubtedly make you a worse historian because you're somehow tailoring what you're saying or what you're thinking to the perceived needs of the present. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether it would help us to have a kind of cadre of, you know, like precogs in Minority Report, you know, historians sitting in kind of, you know, inky tanks, you know, being excluded from the rest of the world and just producing thoughts or facts about the past. I mean, I think all of us are inevitably sucked into what's going on right now. So with that in view, yeah, I mean, I didn't know this maybe as much back in 2017, but I think a lot of us thought that when we got involved in the Oxford volume, that the challenge would be not to make it a book about Trump. Mm-hmm. So the challenge would be to understand that something had happened that looked actually quite different, but that we didn't want to write a whole book that was so fixed in this historical moment that if Trump lost in 2020, that it would have no relevance. And I mean, again, anyone who's written one of these kinds of books will know, the great thing about them is they actually take longer than 4 years. So in a way, you do get a little bit of help from the passage of time. But yeah, I mean, I don't know, I just feel... Maybe also, perhaps you guys have got some insight into this yourselves. It does feel to me that it's a lot easier to talk about the present when you've got a job. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, we don't have jobs.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? It's if we make a kind of political statement, that's reflected on job applications, you know, who's going to, the kind of places that will accept your work or give a forum to it. That's something like just using Twitter, I'm scared of doing at the moment because of the way Twitter is. So, yeah.
And that's a problem, right? So, if we've got to the point where, generationally speaking, you have even more power if you're a bit further on. So, if you're like 50, you can say 20 times more about history and politics than if you're 25. I mean, there are a lot of ways in which older people and older generations have cannibalized or screwed over the future of your generation, I'm sorry to say it. And I would probably include my generation in that, even if I mostly blame my even older neighbors. But like, if that actually then has this impact on saying that you can't really say much about the relationship between history and the present until you get to this point where you have secure employment, that is a real challenge. And if you saw, there was this guy on Twitter, I won't name him just for libel purposes, but there's a guy on Twitter who who's a professor of American religion, who did this big thing last weekend maybe, saying on Twitter, I bet hiring committees now are asking prospective candidates if they agree with the 1619 project, and if they don't agree with it, they don't get jobs. And obviously he got completely piled on, and properly, because all these people are like, why would you say this in a moment where the defunding of departments is happening because either of the sort of migration of people studying American history to other majors, or because of active state legislation intended to stop the teaching of the kinds of things that are in 1619. So why on earth would you run your grill about this? But there is a grain of truth in the idea that I think that you have more privilege and power to be able to make some of these connections when you're a little further on. So I say that in a way not to kind of like just make you guys feel bad, but also to say that there ought to be an understanding by people who are scholars who are a little bit further on in their careers, that this is actually like a massive responsibility too. So I would not necessarily want really to have scholars be like, oh, I don't want to touch that. I would want them to understand that they do have a power to acknowledge the presentness of everything that we do, but that power is also a massive privilege and responsibility because it doesn't belong to everyone else. So again, maybe another thing would be just to make sure that you're actually talking to your students and learning from them and finding ways to figure out the things that they think about these questions that you have a platform to answer, but that they may not feel that they have a platform to answer yet. So.
Yeah, I kind of want to ask here about the narrative part again, because this is kind of relevant, because it's about the stories we tell about the past and that historians tell, and then how other people use those stories and kind of put history to work for ideological purposes. So how can historians in particular like help with that, or like what should history be trying to do in the world, maybe in this particular moment? That's quite a broad question, but you know.
Yeah, well, I certainly don't think that we gain anything from either writing or defending history that is partial or is selective or is kind of slanted. So, I mean, I still, I guess, imagine that the, regardless of what its political usefulness could be, conjuring histories that effectively don't stand the test, you know, of evidence or don't stand the test of argument is not very helpful. So, I mean, in that sense, trying to figure out ways to discuss some of the kind of more hot button issues surrounding American history should not actually be something that becomes ideologically totally divided. Like there ought to be practices and kind of, this is part of what we try and do in academia, right? We try and think about conventions, we try and think about, sort of rules that we can trust, that we can use to hold each other to account. So I'm sort of, suspicious is the wrong word, but I'm sort of conscious of the idea of forms of kind of bad history, which effectively are solely attempting to try to argue a particular political position in the present. I mean, the irony, right, is probably one of the most obvious ones. It's not of the left at all, it's of the right, it's originalism. And it's been absolutely fascinating to think about the ways in which in the last, 40 or 50 years, originalism has gone from being like having no presence whatever to being in effect the, by far, the strongest position in the kind of elite, I mean, certainly not even right-leaning anymore. I mean, a sort of judicial establishment in the US has been captured by that. And there's a really interesting history surrounding that, right, in terms of things like the Federalist Society and also some of the ways in which the GOP has kind of reimagined its sort of legal praxis, I guess. But it's really fascinating to think about that being one of the major places where invoking history has done massive amounts of harm. And I think that also partly comes from the idea that you can't really have a serious conversation in the United States. I mean, this goes back to what I was saying earlier about constitutions. You can't really have a serious conversation in the United States about how just insane it is to imagine that what people thought at the end of the 18th century is actually relevant for now. Again, I sort of feel like I'm touching a third rail in saying that. But I mean, clearly, like, there's constitutional insight, or there's kind of political science, and there's history. And I mean, all of us who are historians can respect political science. You would hope political science would respect history and kind of realize that those are two things that reinforce one another. But this notion, in effect, that we would be going off using history as a way to try and bind communities right now to the genius of people from the end of the 18th century is bonkers. But again, this, I think, is why American history has become so toxic in kind of race terms more recently. I don't mean in terms of the actual kind of practice of, like, you know, racial incarceration or racial violence or whatever else. I just mean in terms of history. Clearly, if what you're saying about the late 18th century is that one of its defining features is racial exclusion, that makes it a lot harder to float the originalist balloon in a way that is so often floated. So that's one of the places where I think, again, it's interesting because in a way, for all of the rhetoric surrounding the ways the left supposedly has sort of operationalized history, actually by far the most important form of skewing history has been from the right. And literally, I mean, it's remaking American society as we speak in the, you know, right majority court. So yeah, so I'm kind of aware of all that, and I don't think any responsible historian of the United States could not be aware of that.
No. Yeah, so I'd actually got written down, were there any political considerations when you were editing the volume? Well, that question seems massively redundant after the last two answers, so I'll skip that.
When you say political considerations, you sound a little bit like one of the questioners in Oppenheimer, you know, on the Congressional Committee. Like, well, what do you mean political considerations?
So I guess what we're kind of getting at is like...
We ask the questions.
I just saw it the other day. It's very good.
Is that right? Yeah.
So what role do you see this book having, if any, within the history wars?
I hope it has no role in history wars. I mean, I define history wars. I mean, what you want is to believe that you can go out there and... I mean, I don't feel that... So if something like 1619, say, I don't think that when the New York Times magazine editor, Jake Sullivan, was putting that together with Nicole Hannah-Jones, that the two of them were like, this is going to be our salvo in history wars, right? I think genuinely what they imagined was, this is a project that can usefully help reorient popular understanding of American history away from the black hole kind of incredibly powerful narrative, which says that the US it begins in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence, and that becomes the kind of soil from which the flower of liberty grows. And the, you know, liberty is this kind of, to change my metaphors, you know, it's this circle that gets ever bigger and everyone finally falls into it. So I mean, I think when they were writing that book, they weren't thinking, we want to have a history war, we want to try and launch our missiles into whatever. I think genuinely they're thinking, hey, wouldn't it be good if this narrative and emphasis were out there? It became phenomenally successful, and a lot of what then became the history wars or the culture wars in our current moment in the United States was a reaction from people who went from the sort of center right of the political spectrum all the way through the furthest right bits of the political spectrum. Incredibly, I mean, people whose piss was boiled to an enormous extent by this notion of taking 1776 away from them. But again, this comes back to the question of kind of who writes American history. For the longest time, I think a lot of those folks, including some of these people, you know, like Sean Wilentz or Jim Oakes or Jim McPherson or Gordon Wood, these guys did not see themselves as being in any way right-wing. Quite the opposite. They saw themselves as being liberals. But they were from a community of liberals that imagined that their ownership over American history was near complete, and that you could finesse aspects of exclusion and discrimination in American history with this kind of expanding circle definition. So, I mean, that is a sort of potted history to my understanding of how 1619 became part of the history wars. But nobody who was involved in that project thought, hey, wouldn't it be great to have a war? And in the same way, like putting together this volume, what you want to try and do is get really qualified, you know, outstanding, you know, the most amazing historians you can get your hands of to tell you about the American past in ways that you think are honest, but also ways that you think are creative. So you don't want them to be, you don't want to phone it in, right? So you want to give them the freedom to be able to shape things, to tell stories that are familiar and not so familiar. But the last thing you want is to feel when that book's done, oh, someone's going to use this and they're going to like swipe a Trump supporter with it. I mean, no. I mean, I don't know how the history wars end. I guess they never do. But in a way, I think what we sometimes think of as a history war is a reaction to something that's actually helped to move the dial a little bit. So it'd be lovely to move the dial with this, but it's probably a very ambitious thing to hope for. And I certainly wouldn't compare what we're doing to 1619. But yeah, it would be fantastic to help to move the dial a bit. Be lovely to shift some copies. Be great to have people think of some of the things we do in the book, which are quite kind of new, as being ways in which it would be good to narrate in American history from now on. That would be awesome, but no war if we could get around it.
So I wanted to jump on what you said about telling history in ways that are honest.
Yeah, yeah.
And without meaning to disregard what you said about not wanting to end up in a history war,
yeah, no,
the kind of overriding culture at the moment is that those history wars exist.
Yeah.
So what kind of responsibilities do you feel as an editor when publishing a work like this into that context? And I think maybe what you said about honesty probably plays into that.
Oxford had been great. Like, I kept expecting Oxford would be problematic, and they would be like, okay, we want to see everything you've written, and we want to, but they, not at all, they're not. So they place a lot of trust, I guess, in me. And genuinely, my major like editorial intervention, or my major editorial work, has been just to read the chapters really carefully and make sure they're as clear as they can be. And I mean, if there's stuff in it I don't understand, then I'm keen for the person who's writing the chapter to reword that or rephrase that or write more, or to make sure the reader can understand it. So genuinely, that's been kind of the extent of it. Now, I mean, there are some things about the way that the book is structured. So just to give you one example, the fact that the penultimate chapter of the book is by the Lumbee historian Melinda Lowry, and it's basically about modern Native America. So I made a decision quite early on, before I'd actually found an author, that I would like a dedicated 20th century chapter on Indigenous people, rather than one you might get in some books, like a chapter on 19th century Indigenous history, because the 19th century chapters already have quite a bit of Indigenous history. So I wanted that to be either the last chapter of the book or the penultimate chapter of the book. Now, I imagine that if that were exposed to some of the more kind of, what should we say, for hire history warriors here in the UK or in the US, that would be seen as a quote unquote woke gesture. But it's nonsense, right? I mean, like, it's incredibly important to think about the persistence of Indigenous Americans, but also to think about the way the Native Americans in the US have very often been either pioneers or kind of canaries in the mine for all kinds of developments that have gone on over the 20th century, especially in terms of citizenship and exclusion and struggles for equality. And then even things like struggles for sovereignty. So trying to figure out the relationship between Indigenous sovereignty, federal citizenship, state sovereignty, and so on. And more recently, thinking about some of the Dakota Access Pipeline stuff, just the kind of bleeding edge of this environmental catastrophe that we're in, and the ways in which Indigenous people have kind of pioneered in that space too. So to me, it was really obvious that that was a chapter. So before I'd talked to Melinda and persuaded her to do it, I made, I guess, the decision that that's what we should have. But again, it's not, when Melinda wrote a chapter, it was awesome. It didn't need much doing to it. And I don't know, like, now if the book comes out and are people like, well, there's a whole chapter about Native Americans in the present. My guess is people who see that, whose politics are, what should we say, more traditional, or people that want a more traditional narrative of American history, I bet they won't find a way to criticize that, but they'll probably stew about it. But then, like, why are they stewing about it? You know, what does it mean to be anti-woke?
What does woke mean?
I mean,
I've personally stopped listening when people say woke, because I just can't.
Well, if I'm being honest, I think from the perspective of race in particular, woke means someone who is committed to the idea of correcting a vision of the past or the present that was racially exclusionary. I'm sorry to say it, but genuinely do.
Is that the same terms on which so-called woke people are?
Of course not. Okay,
that's my.
But we know, well, I mean, American listeners wouldn't know about this, but we know this from back in the 80s, right? So when people talked about the loony left or loony left councillors, you go back and you see the stuff the loony left councillors were doing back then. They were basically promoting programs of equality for gay people and disabled people. That was it. Mm-hmm. So like the idea that you get called woke now, it's exactly the same. And it may well be the case that there are a bunch of people that use that word that aren't completely aware of the fact that they're doing this. But in the context of American history in particular, I totally get that it's a massive challenge to have wrenched away from you the comfort of all men are created equal as something which applies to everyone, or at the very least, which is expanding in American history to include everyone. And I think that that's been the major kind of nightmare, I guess, in terms of the history wars or the culture wars in the US, that there are a bunch of people that do not want that that fantasy, that kind of comforting fiction, taken away from them. But if you turn it around and you actually center the experience of people that did continue to be discriminated against or excluded, or, I mean, even bonkers stuff, right? Like thinking about the fact that racial segregation in American cities in the first decade of the 21st century is getting worse, or at least according to the statistics from the census. Like stuff like that, you're just like, how is that possible if all men are created equal is in fact the thing I think it is? So I think that that's fueled a lot of stuff there. And again, I get it, because nobody wants to be the bad guy. Nobody's happy embracing forms of like racial villainy. And nobody wants to feel that a society that they're very invested in precisely because of the principle of equality was perhaps not quite as good at delivering that in fundamental ways to whole communities of people that they're not very connected with, those people who have the faith in it. So I think a lot of this anti-woke stuff is actually functionally racist. I'm not scared to say it. Although, again, if you were a bit younger, maybe you would be scared to say it. And I think as historians of the US, we can prove that, right? Because it's like, well, what are the narratives that these reactionaries are trying to shut down? I mean, what is it that DeSantis is trying to ban. And you go off and you see what it is, right? And it's stuff that plays with some of these liberal, many of them liberal, liberal or conservative kind of sacred cows, in effect. You know, I mean, these things that can't be challenged, so.
Yeah. No, thank you. That's a very frank answer. Which we always appreciate on here.
Well, it's easy to say if you've got a job, right? I mean, this is why what DeSantis is doing in particular, what's going on in with Greg Abbott in Texas is so concerning, because in effect, what you won't have in a society is the ability to speak freely about this stuff if people could get fired for it.
I think this is, when we mentioned political considerations earlier, this was one of the things. So obviously you can sidestep this by saying this book has been published in the UK. Mm-hmm. You're obviously British, mm-hmm. working out of British university. But a lot of your writers are American. Yep. So did that factor into their writing at all? I don't know how you would know that. But yeah, that climate, how does it impact upon this book?
Well, the people who are most vulnerable right now are people that teach American history at institutions which are state-run. So in other words, they're public universities rather than private universities in states where there's either already been a pretty secure kind of capture by very right-leaning Republicans, or there's a threat of one. So I'm not sure it's impossible to imagine that there could be a moment where a swing state like Wisconsin could end up being in this space. But the two major ones are the two states that we were always told, like back in the early 2000s, were bound to go blue sometime soon, which are Florida and Texas. And we actually don't have anyone in the volume, I think. I don't think we have anyone in the volume who's actually teaching at a state institution in Florida or in Texas. But when you think for a moment about how important the state university systems are in those two places, amazing people have come out of them or are still working in them. The idea that those two states might actually find themselves in a place where a tenured professor could lose their job for teaching a particular book, or for speaking out in a particular way which violates a state law, essentially kind of mandating the opposite of freedom of speech, it's really alarming. And I mean, there are lots of things in our historical moment which are distressing, and lots of things which are, like, the difficulty becomes figuring out, like, when to freak out, right? Because they're on every different kind of, like, metric. You could be
all the time.
Yeah, but precisely, you could yeah. be. But then you're like, well, actually, maybe every generation is like every age. I mean, look, go back at the 17th century Puritans. Like, they freaked out about everything, right? I mean, they had a lot to freak out about, it's true. But, like, they had a whole kind of literary form, the Jeremiah, dedicated to freaking out about stuff. But I do think there are some fairly existential or kind of major things going on right now in the United States and the world, which mean that, there's a particular kind of danger or kind of... I'm more nervous, I guess, about the study of history and the ability to be able to speak candidly than in the past. And I think part of what's gone on in the US and definitely here in the UK is that the right's captured most places and it hasn't captured universities for some fairly obvious reasons, right? Which is just that universities tend to pay nowhere near as well as the private sector. In the UK, universities pay, you know, I mean, I wouldn't recommend somebody wants to go off and be in like Dragon's Den that they become a university professor. Like, that would be a very bad idea. So I don't know, the entrepreneurial spirit or whatever, like that's meant that universities have in many respects been these kinds of, you know, if you're on the right, you look at them, you're like, oh, the universities again. But actually, in a way, when a society has been captured in so many ways by the logic of the market and the right, you end up running out of stuff if you're a right-wing politician to get upset about, right? So it's like, well, there are those universities we could go and kick the shit out of. So that, I think, both in the US and in the UK, is one of the reasons that we're in this kind of culture war right now. But it is important to say that it's not a war between historians. So it tends to be a war between people that have actually got professional qualifications and those that haven't. So in that sense, I don't want to pull rank. You know, I mean, I know we don't believe in experts anymore in this country, and then we got Brexit. But, like, there is a sense, a really strong sense, to me, that what's going on is actually a kind of resentment at the way that the profession, the people that have actually put in the hard yards, they line up many times in a fairly together way on a lot of these kind of basic changes to understanding the American past. And again, that's upset many people who are politicians or folks who are in the wider culture who just think universities are places of kind of infantile left play as opposed to serious study and stuff. And I mean, again, you guys know this because you're here. I mean, you know, kind of hold you accountable. That's how it works. So
mm-hmm. I think we can, yeah, we'll ask the final question. So Caleb, do you want to have that one?
So just to finish it all off, nuts and bolts question: if you were going to do it again, if you were going to do the whole process again, would you change anything about the process?
There's one chapter which I've had trouble with, just in terms of the author being fantastic but actually having a lot of other stuff going on in their life, and that's the only chapter right now that's not totally locked down. So there's like that chapter that I might think about differently, and I would rather COVID hadn't happened. because we did all of our workshopping on Zoom, so we did still get everyone to kind of come together and stuff. But no, at this point of the process, maybe I'll feel differently when it's out and I can kind of gauge the reaction to it, which might be no reaction at all. But at this point, it's just felt like this is incredibly fun ride and this incredible privilege. And you know, you don't often get the chance. I mean, it's often seen that like editing a book, if you're an academic, it's kind of a nightmarish job because you have to have a conference first of all, and a conference is really miserable, and then like you have to go around trying to drag people into writing stuff for the conference and then edit what they do, and it's all miserable, right? But actually this has been a really, really different experience for me. And yeah, and I think there's a lot of energy from the folks we put together, and I can't think of any of them that haven't knocked it out of the park. So genuinely, in terms of what they've produced, it's been tremendous. So yeah, I mean, I'm you know, I feel like I'm the only weak link in the book, and I'm only writing a chapter because two people were supposed to have written up to a particular point, and then one decided to end earlier and the other to pick up a bit later. So the only reason that my chapter is going to exist in the book is because there was suddenly this hole and I came really cheap. Literally, I came cheap because I took less money than anyone else would. So but no, it's been awesome. It's been fantastic. And yeah, and it's pretty nice to talk to you guys about it. So thank you very much.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much, Nick, for joining us. Thank you, Caleb, as well. So yeah, we'll finish there.
All right, thank you.
And that was Professor Nick Geyer and Caleb Woodall discussing Nick's new, soon-to-be-released volume, The Oxford Illustrated History of the United States. This will be the last episode of the podcast for a while. We'll be back in the Michaelmas term later in the year. We hope you enjoy and have a lovely summer. Thank you very much. Bye.